going to talk about here is what is space. Okay, and in fact, maybe more, we're going to see why I'm thinking that. What is quantum space? Okay, and the first thing that for me started this quest is the fact that, I mean, classical space in modern physics plays a role in all our construction, the locality of asymptotic states, the definition of field theory, the interpretation, the notion of observer. I mean, you can go on and on and on and on. It's somehow classical space is embedded everywhere in our modern concept about physics, even the most modern elements of physics. And it's kind of strange that quantum mechanics, so if we exclude, let's say, quantum gravity, the subcommunity of quantum gravity people, quantum mechanics hasn't played any role in our understanding or interpretation of what space is. And that always really struck me as something absolutely bizarre, especially in the light, if you read the original papers by Heisenberg, Born, and Jordan about the discovery of quantum mechanics, because for them, the discovery of quantum mechanics was a fundamental question about the notion of motion, fundamental questions about motion in space, and they had to give up in some sense. For them, the discovery of quantum mechanics came hand in hand with the complete refoundation of the notion of space. And subsequently, let's say, I would say the big culprits for me are Schrodinger and von Neumann. You know, this kind of got disappeared in the textbook. And today we have a presentation of quantum mechanics which doesn't question at all what space is. Okay, so I want to go back to this 1922, this moment of discovery of quantum mechanics, and why I think that somehow, you know, quantum mechanics should affect the way we think about space. So let me try to convince that. This is a work done with collaboration with George Minnick and Rob Lee, which are two string theorists, and now, you know, they become quantum foundationalists too. Because of the questions we were looking at. Let me try, Ravi encouraged me to be very provocative, so I'm going to try to, because I want this talk, I mean, to be, as I say, more of a conversation, so just stop me. I'm not claiming, for me, it's the beginning of a discussion. It's not, I'm not presenting the end of something. So let me tell you what is my manifesto, the two things that somehow are going to be in the backbone of what I say. So, my quantum manifesto, if you want. Okay? The first thing is that quantum, for me, this is really why I'm doing that. Quantum is more fundamental than classical. Okay? So the manifesto is the world is quantum, right? And the second thing, I'm going to explain more, you know, what that really means and what that really implies. And the second thing is that, let me put it first negatively, is that we haven't understood yet the principle of relativity. So let me be precise. In the context of quantum mechanics, you know, is not fully understood yet. Okay? And what I really mean by that is that if we want, I'll explain that. And for me, there's an extension of this principle of relativity that should allow us to understand what relativity means in the presence of superposition of states, for instance, which I call the principle of relative locality. Okay. So that's somehow the manifesto. And these two things are, in fact, you know, I came to this second one thinking about that first one. But I cannot claim one is more fundamental than the other. I do believe that this is really what I'm trying to talk about here. Quantum is more fundamental than classical. What does that mean? It means that, you know, if I just think about what the quantum is, for me, it's a simple object. What's weird for me is really the classical world, the emergence of classical world inside a quantum brain. I know that's somehow kind of the contrary of the usual picture, right? In the usual picture of quantum information, for instance, you know, the notion of classical reality is taken as granted and unique. And in this classical reality, you know, we can define the notion of observer, which has knobs, he has a beard, he, you know, he has dice, he can take decisions to turn left and right. And then when he looks at the quantum world, he explores somehow the weirdness of it. So I somehow want to kind of reverse that logic. For me, this observer with his beard and his knob is a weird object. And I'm always wondering how come he came there? You know, what is he, why is he making such decision? What is its fundamental nature from the point of view of the quantum world? So this is the challenge. If you believe that the world is quantum, or that quantum is more fundamental than classical, then your challenge is to somehow understand the emergence and of stability of the classical world as we seem to witness it. Okay, so that's really my challenge. And essentially, why is that related to space? Because my proxy, so when I talk about the observer, it seems it's something which is really charged with too many preconceived notion. But the ultimate proxy for what I mean by observer is going to be space itself. So if you replace observer in your concept by space, and in fact, you know, in many ways, you can think of space as being somehow the ultimate observer, or let's say any observer is somehow, you know, embedded in some kind of classical space there. Okay, so because if I think of space, then I can maybe start to think about this question in a more mathematical manner. But as a first step of trying to understand this interplay between classical and quantum. So now, I mean, of course, you know, it sounds bizarre because as a mathematician, and it confused me for many years, of course, as a mathematician, I know what classical means, right? I mean, to have classical, I take h bar to zero limit, right? And then I just look at the physics I can probe with observable that survives that classical limit. Okay, that's one way as a mathematician we think about classical limit. This is a parameter, continuous parameter we can tune. And then in that limit, you know, in some sense, classical physics is well defined on its own. But the challenge is that when you do physics, you know, there's no such thing as a tunable h-bar parameter. So h-bar is what it is. And in fact, in any physical system, we have coexistence of somehow, you know, quantum objects with classical objects. And I'd like to understand a little bit better and think about, let's say, quantum object as matter and classical object as space. That's the ultimate divide we kind of all have agreed on up to now.
But things like superposition of different spatial-time structures are going to make an appearance, or?
Yeah. I would say yes. That's the next step. That's where I want to go. Yes. It is true that in the formulation we have of physics today, we cannot talk about these propositions of different causal structure. It's kind of forbidden. It's assumed that, okay, we don't have h-bar goes to zero limit, but we usually think of classical limits. We replace it by something. So, okay, we cannot tune h-bar, but how do we think about classical? Maybe we think in terms of some kind of decoherence, which goes, you know, some way towards trying to separate the two, but not really fully. So we are thinking of somehow coarse graining, right? So the way, and what do we mean? In some sense, you know, naively we have this picture that classical objects are kind of very large. And very large means maybe, well, we are, you know, maybe large numbers of degrees of freedom or very big. And what is the ultimate biggest object in the universe? Well, it's the universe itself. Okay? So, you know, by extension, we're just saying, okay, well, you know, that's why universe has to be somehow classical, I guess. And then quantum, it's very small. Okay? So let's say, like, you know, quantum particle or matter, spin. Okay, quantum particle, small stuff. And so we see here, in some sense, that this is where these two questions about, so this distinction between classical and quantum, which is, I think for me, let's say this is my formulation of the measurement problem, is that if I believe that the world is quantum, I have to explain you what do I mean by classical reality. And that's not an easy task. But we realize that this notion of classical and quantum are tied up with this notion of large and small. So they're really, you know, inherently coupled with the notions of space and ultimately time. Okay, so I cannot, this is why I cannot really, you know, disentangle the notion of classical quantum between understanding the separations of scale in physics. Okay? Now, let's see, say, one important subtlety in this limit h bar goes to zero is that one I say is that in physics, h bar is fixed, right? But there's another subtlety which was really put forward by Aronoff, okay? And it's going to be an important role. In my is that there is a collection of variables which have only a purely quantum existence, and these are called modular observables. Are quantum. By that I mean they have no classical analog. Okay, so when we talk about the classical limit as a mathematician, what we're doing is essentially excluding from the sets of possible observables that we can use to probe the system all the observables which are quantum only in some sense, which are these modular observables. And the poster boy for a modular observable would be as Aronoff, you know, say, suppose it's like the two-slit experiment. So suppose you look at a two-slit experiment and you prepare, you know, wave function psi of x, which is the sum of psi 1 of x plus, let's say, a phase, the same object. So psi 1 is located here, and then psi 2 is going to be located there, right? And what we want to do is measure the phase here. And what Aronoff has shown is that you can take any classical observables, no matter how complicated they are, so any collections or linear combinations of Pn and Qm compute its expectation value in that state, psi alpha, take the derivative with respect to alpha, and this is always zero for all n and m. Okay? So no matter what classical observables you're going to use, you will never, ever be able to probe the phase of interference. Okay? But there exist observables, which are essentially phases, observables like that, for which this is not true. Okay. So these modular observables here, sorry, let me put the hat. They have two characteristics. First, to define them, because they are essentially, the modular observable is essentially the momenta modulo a period, right? And in order to define a phase from a momenta, I need to introduce a scale, okay? So it's impossible to define, it's very important, that it's impossible to define Aronoff-Bohm phases if you don't have a fundamental scale or an apparatus scale to bring in your system, okay? And the second point is that it's clear that in the limit where h bar goes to zero, this observable is at best, or it's somehow the best definition of what undefined means, right? Okay? So it absolutely doesn't survive the classical limit. Now, another thing we're going to use is that these modular observables, so they are kind of fundamentally quantum. And a property which is going to be very important for us, it's a very surprising property. Right? We think of quantum as being non-commutative, and it is, right, compared to classical. It has more non-commutative directions than classical. Any question on that? This is, I know this is standard. Okay.
You use modular in the sense of mathematician?
I use modular in the sense of Aronoff, as modular observables. That is, observables defined modulo. So, right? So the modular momenta as would be, is essentially here P modulo H bar over L. Okay, it's an angle.
So a magnetic flux in your sense is a modular.
Yeah, for instance, I mean, this is, you know, this is, it's not a surprise it came from Aronoff, because this is essentially how Aronoff first had the idea of revealing the observability of the potential by looking at observables, which are modular. So the Aronoff-Bohm phases are, you know, the first example of modular, Aronoff-Bohm momenta are the first example of modular observables. Yeah?
Just wanted to get clear on your reasons for saying that e to the I of TL over h bar has no classical analog, whereas p to the n, q to the m does. So you're saying that, you know, these
in the limit
variables have no classical analog, according to you. But, I mean, you said, for example, that, you know, h bar in physics is what it is. And I could, in a classical theory, say, well, I'm going to choose my momentum scale to be h bar over L for some L. And then talk about the classical theory, you know, talk about the momentum modulo of that momentum scale. So there's nothing that prevents me from describing a classical analog of that modular observable. So I just want to know,
well, in some sense,
where do you see the difference?
In some sense, this is what these quantum space are, modular space are about. So the ability to somehow include, that's where I'm going. But today, we don't have this language. So in some sense, this is where I want to go. That's one direction where I want to go. Here, I'm thinking, well, in the naive definition, where I think in terms of h bar goes to zero limit as classical, which is, you know, a definition that lots of people uses, then they don't survive that particular limit. Now, yeah, I think you're picking my punchline there. I give my punchline. Part of my punchline is that somehow, well, is there, you know, let's put it as a question, is there somehow a notion of classical reality for which these observables are part of the real? Okay? And that's essentially what, so space as we know it doesn't have a scale, and therefore it cannot support such fundamental observables. But that's what modular space is supposed to be. And we're going to see to what extent they are. Okay, and then the devil is in the detail. Okay, so maybe ask me that same question a little bit later. That's somehow the whole purpose of the talk, to go there. Yes.
So I want to come to this notion of classical being large and quantum being small. I would take the opposite perspective, which is that only with classical things can we resolve distances. Only if I've got objects, equipment, experiments, and so on, can I perform, can I make distinction between here and someplace near to here. Whereas with quantum states, fundamentally, quantum states are global. I can't say a quantum state is just here, this location. A quantum state is a global thing. And so, in fact, the quantum state has no location,
mm-hmm.
whereas the classical state is what allows me to define location.
Yeah, I can. I mean, here you're bringing forward some kind of the maybe the tension. So here, when I was talking about large, it's just the fact that, you know, if I have a quantum mechanical system, the way to take effectively the h bar goes to zero limit is to increase the number of components, so that effectively h bar compared to the center of mass is relatively small. Now, what you're saying is that in the picture we have about the classical, it is true that the classical picture in the, you know, classical particle has infinite resolution. So bizarrely, this large object is assumed to be infinitely small. Okay? In some sense, you're helping me. You're just bringing forward the total inconsistency of this picture. But I didn't want. And then the same thing for the other one. I agree. I'm not saying that, you know. So for me, it's an extra motivation that we have to. We cannot. In some sense, let me go back to I'm saying quantum is more fundamental than classical. I said it in a provocative manner because for most people it's the other way around. And let's say, in some sense, if I think of pure quantum mechanics, there's no issue with it. If I think about pure classical mechanics, there's no issue about it. The tension comes when I try to have coexisting phases of objects which are classical and quantum. And this is what I want to, in a broader perspective, resolve. I'm not saying I'm going to resolve that but you know, I want to give that broader perspective so that you can relate to it in a, you know, to some quantum foundational questions that you usually like. Okay. So, you know, because in physics we do have coexistence of large and small. Maybe another thing where I wanted to emphasize is the fact that, let's say, about the universe itself. So I'm going to question the fact that the universe itself is taken as a classical object. And that might be weird. Like, look for whether it's possible to do superpositions of what a space is. What are the evidence in today's physics that, in fact, I have to do that? And I would say that in today's physics, there's a very interesting debate, which was discovered in the 70s, but is reopening right now, which is a debate around the soft modes. So we are discovering, again, that if we do quantum field theory in a relativistic context, there's really two phases of the theory. Either the theory is massive, and it has a unique vacua, okay? And in some sense, I can think of this substrate of the vacua as being some kind of classical object, which is unmovable, okay? But what we are now understanding really sharply and clearly is that I can look at massless object, and most likely, you know, Young-Mills, QED, gravity. And what we know now is that there's an infinite number of vacua. And moreover, what we know, what we're learning is that this vacua supports an infinite number of possible Aronoff-Bohm phases. With, you know, which distinguish. So the notion of Aronoff-Bohm phases, which is somehow a purely quantum mechanical notion, makes its reappearance in the foundations of quantum field theory itself. And I mean, here, let me advertise, there's going to be a conference on December 7 and 8. So for people who are interested in the foundations of relativistic quantum field theory, you know, we have a conference on the infrared problem in quantum field theory about that. So there's a mounting evidence that in fact, when we try to look out at what is the zero energy sector, what is the notion of pure space from the point of view of gravity, it is fundamentally quantum. And what does that mean is that in QED, it means that in fact, when we look at the motion of charged particle, it's constantly measured, but very weakly measured by the trace it leaves onto these Aronoff-Bohm phases, which are collections of soft photons. Soft photons have zero energy, so they don't decohere the system. And this is essentially, you know, what hasn't been really metabolized yet in the quantum field theory is to understand and metabolize the fact that we have an infinite number of vacua which measure constantly what's going on in the universe but never decoheres it. And that's really the frontier of what people are doing today in field theory and quantum gravity, in my view. So that's a very interesting, maybe, meeting point.
Laurent?
Yes?
When you say that there are our Aronoff-Bohm phase, do you mean that each vacua has one phase, or the vacua...
It means that there's the vacuas can be characterized, there's an algebra, which is like a charge density and a phase density, if you want, which are conjugate to each other. And then, you know, either you think of a vacuum as being a well-defined state in a charge density, or more likely a superposition of you know, Aronoff-Bohm, or a superposition of vacua, which then are going to be differing from each other from their phases. I don't really want to, I mean, does that, it's really phases that you know, will enter, because I have an infinite number of vacua, I can create superpositions. And then superpositions can carry phases, and these are exactly these soft modes, okay? And the debate today is whether these phases, it's funny that the debate today is exactly the same as the debate that was taking rage in, you know, when Aronoff proposed the reality of Aronoff-Bohm phases. There are people saying, no, they are not real. You know, we cannot measure them because they are relative observables. Same thing here. There are, you know, mounting evidence that you should take them into account, but there are people where there are lots of discussions around whether they're real or not. So there's a quantum field theory analog discussion of what happened in the 60s, which is happening right now today. So give me extra incentive for maybe not considering right away that the pure space is a classical object, if you were not convinced by the rest. Maybe questions about that? Or it's, is that clear? Half an hour. Is that okay? I may not be able to explain the details of the modular space, but tell me to speed up. But I wanted to give the context in which this work takes place, so then maybe we can, because the modular space construction is very technical, and I can go through, and if people are interested, maybe we can have another instances. Let me say something important, because when I say, and nobody say that, I think you're very polite today, because when I say quantum is fundamental, usually what I hear is that, you know, if I say that to my quantum foundationalist friends, they're going to tell me, oh, you believe in many words. And they give me this, sorry, look, I'm sorry for you. Right? And I'm like, no, I don't know. I don't want. But then, you know, they give me an argument, and it seems pretty good that if you believe that quantum mechanics is fundamental, you have to believe that, you know, you have to believe in many worlds in some sense. And I feel trapped. For me, the best paper I've ever read on many worlds is a paper, even better than Everett, is this paper by Lupkin, where he proposed the probabilistic interpretation from decompositions of subsystems of the wave function. But even if I look at that, I still want to believe that the world is quantum, but somehow I don't really want to fully be a many world person. So the purpose of this project is also to carve a space for myself where I can believe that the world is quantum, but there's only one world. Okay, that's really, I'm not claiming I'm going to do that today, but this is really the aim. From a quantum foundation perspective, I do believe it's possible to do that, especially in the light of the discussion we were having with Rob, that in some sense, if we extend the notion of classical realities that we can tag as good classical realities, then something which is many in one reality is in fact one in the other, right? And if you know a little bit about the quantum, you know that, you know, in quantum, it's very confusing how to count. Okay, so what is one and what is many? It depends. It depends on the choice of your basis. A physical implementation where this is very true is the notion of quasi-particle. Okay, so quasi-particle is a fundamental, let's say, quantum Hall effect that half-filling fraction. You can describe it in terms of a Dirac electron, which is one. Okay, and the fundamental fixations are Fock space of Dirac electron around the vacua. So now this Dirac electron at nu equal 1/2, it's one object, okay? And there's many experiments where you see even the trajectory, like, you know, I mean, they are pretty remarkable. It's a free, it's a completely free object. So it's not nothing really special or bizarre about it. Okay. But if you ask how this object relates to the electron, which is located in the laboratory, then it's completely delocalized states of the standard electron, and it's made of an infinite or a large number of electrons. So is the quasar particle at New Equilibrium one or many? It really depends. It depends on which basis you think is fundamental for your counting. So here, this is somehow the statement I want to revisit. So many words, you know, if I believe in quantum mechanics, I'm going to say, you know, the electron, so it's one electron, is at two places at the same time. Right? That's kind of the weird statement that you would say, and that maybe everybody feels uncomfortable with. And if you look at this object, I mean, I cannot deny that there's one electron. So let's say I'm not going to change that. And let me assume that I'm in relativistic quantum mechanics, so I don't really yet question the notion of time. So the only place where I can change something is the notion of places. So this notion of places, how do I count that it's two places? I count that it's two places because I have a preconceived notion of what is my classical space-time, right? I have a notion of what x is. But imagine, and what I'm going to devise, and this is what modular space does, is that I'm going to propose a new notion of locality, which is fundamentally adaptive to the quantum, where an object which is at one place in a modular space is in fact at many places with respect to the classical notion of space. Okay? So being, and I'm going to, place equal, you know, essentially equal being at many places. Okay, so the notion of many words depends on your notion, on your choice of basis. It depends on what you mean by locality. If, of course, for you, X is an absolute classical object, then I agree with you, you have a problem. You cannot believe that you have quantum mechanics as fundamental and that space is this classical fundamental object. So this is the place I want to carve. I want to, do you follow me? Do you see why? For me, I believe that somehow foundational questions and quantum gravity questions are hands in hand because of that exact tension. That there may be a notion of space which allow me, you know, to be one, even if some other notion of space counts many. Is that too weird? Too simple?
I can't see how it's going to work. I mean, if you had a continuous superposition of, you know, a particle over many different positions, say a Gaussian or something, then it doesn't seem like modularity can.
I'm going to give one example. Okay. I'm not developing, right? I'm going to give one example where this is essentially what happens. Okay. Whether, you know, it resolves all the paradox, etc. That's like, I think this is where I like to start a conversation. But I think this idea that the notion of places might be not what you think it is. It's a very fruitful notion. And it's essentially the idea of relative locality. This is exactly the same idea. Okay, so what is relative locality? This is what I just stated. It's the idea that the notion of locality, where you are, is not an absolute notion. It depends on your choice of whatever observer, basis, depends on the type of probes you're using. And it goes back to the principle of relativity is not fully understood yet. What is it that we don't understand about the relativity? If there is any theorist in the room, it seems very strange to hear such a statement, because maybe there's none. But in field theory, you know, you claim that the big success of field theory is that we have the complete understanding of what it means to do quantum relativistic quantum mechanics. So what's missing there? Yes?
What's missing is general relativity. We don't understand the relationship between the
okay, quantum, so let's say there's the
and the geometry and
There is relativity, but even if I grant you, I'm saying even before, I know that usually, okay, I'm going to talk about quantum gravity too, which is my motivation, but what I'm saying is that I want to say something more than that. I want to say that even before we try to curve the geometry, even in the context of flat geometry, there's an incompleteness.
But there's an assumption that flat geometry is somehow given as opposed to gaining its existence from the matter, and so...
Yeah, there is, but there are books where, you know, you have an axiomatic derivation and it seems pretty airtight. And you have algebraic quantum field theory, which pretends they can almost define what a quantum field theory is from first principle based on locality. And I agree with you, but if you try to wedge in, it looks like you're against a very perfect structure, which has been developed since the 1950s, right? And it's one of the most successful construction with the standard model. So I think there's two ways in which the principle of relativity is not fully understood. The first way, which is the way I came in, is kind of a classical picture, and that might not be the most correct, is the fact that in any physical system, if you turn on quantum mechanics, there is always scales in the system. It's never really true that you have matter, that you have a scaleless system, okay? So no system without scales, essentially because quantum mechanics delocalizes the objects. And the only way you can have no scale is, as you were saying, is having this idea of classical point-like objects. I'm going to use your argument of quantum gravity, which is that if I believe in quantum gravity, then it's clear that then I have a serious problem because there's a fundamental landscape. Okay, we have the Planck lens and the Planck mass. Okay, so we have a fundamental length scale and a fundamental energy scale. So it means that if we want to understand quantum gravity, we have to understand the principle of relativity in the context of fundamental scale. Okay, so what is relativity with fundamental scales? Okay? That's what we see. Now, you say, okay, well, it sounds very quantum gravity-like. And in some sense, you know, my second manifesto is that for me, this is what I mean by quantum gravity. If you give me a theory of quantum, which has the principle of relativity and respects with the fundamental scale, in my view, you do have a theory of quantum gravity. Okay, so that's kind of the challenge. If you can do that, so you can think of the problem of quantum gravity as just developing quantum mechanics with a fundamental scale. You don't have to be a specialist in string theory or loop gravity or whatever. You can start from scratch from that perspective. It's a very, very powerful way of thinking about the problem. And I invite you to try because, you know, sometimes this problem of quantum gravity looks like it's only a few specialists with humongous baggage and tools and technical expertise that can think about the problem, but I don't think so. I think at core, it's about that issue. Now, okay, that's somehow the quantum gravity perspective. The other perspective is where is that the relativity principle doesn't work? Is that it doesn't apply to superpositions of space. Okay, so if you give me a state, so if you think about the principle, the relativity principle, it is a classical concept. You think that you have one space, and in that one space, you make a Boost transformation. And then you try to formulate everything with respect to that space. Okay? And essentially, what it means is that you have a field phi, and then, you know, on this field, you have a notion of space here. Okay? But now suppose that I invent a notion of locality, or that I call big X, which in fact, you know, so let's say, you know, the usual way we think about physics, and let's say phi could be the metric, the usual way we think about physics is that what we should do is put hats there. Okay, but the X stays the same. Okay, what I'm going to look here is the other way, is that if you think about what a field is, some kind of pairing of an object which carries excitations of your field located at some position. It's a pairing between the two. So what if, you know, that object is a quantum system, which in fact it is originally. And it means that you can think of trying to think about fields which are located on the superpositions of spaces. That's really, you know, that's one element of quantum gravity. One element of quantum gravity is to curve the, is to quantize the gravitational field and look for very high curvature. The other element of quantum gravity is to try to explain what does it mean to superpose space. Okay? These questions of what does it mean to superpose space, it survives the limit where the gravity metric is flat. Okay? So it's a question about quantum mechanics. It's not a question about string theory or loop gravity. Okay? And that's the question I want to... So essentially, suppose that you have a superposition of state like that, x plus ai. You know, can you expand the principle of relativity to such objects? And
I think the essence of quantum mechanics versus classical mechanics is that quantum mechanics is Q numbers, commutators of P and Q for non pairs. C numbers, that's not true. So in order to do quantum mechanics space, you need to do Q number space, which has been very difficult.
I'll come back. Give me a minute. I think it's a very good question about what commutes and what doesn't. Okay, but let me finish with that. So this, what we're going to see, I want to give, this is what modular space is. Modular space is an example where somehow I can extend the notion so suppose, you know, I have such a superposition, and then I look at the transform guy, where for some reason I rotate, you know, let's say I give you some rules for rotating the phases, and then some rules for boosting the object like that. A priori, it's a completely different state. It has absolutely no relationship with whatever I started with. But in this modular space, I can show that such a transformed state is, in fact, unitarily related to the original one. Okay? So there are, you know, these modular spaces, and that's going to be part of the memo, is not only they give a notion, a new notion of classicality, a new notion of space, but they allow yourself to extend the principle of relativity to superposition. That's its main function, if you want. And now, if you think about superposition, in order to define superpositions, you have to introduce phases, right? That measures the coherency or not of the relative motions. And phases require a scale. So you cannot, these two problems are the same. You cannot extend the principle of relativity to superposition if you don't understand how to extend the principle of relativity to space-time with a fundamental scale or some scale in it. Is that, if you understand that, that somehow they are related, the detail now, yes?
So I'm confused about something that, so I would think of the relativity principle as asserting that the dynamical laws will look the same regardless of which Lorentz frame you're in. But classically, you know, it does follow that the physical state of a system ought to be independent of what Lorentz frame I'm describing it relative to. In fact, it's not. So insofar as the quantum state seems to be more like the classical state of the system, why would I want that to be invariant under my choice of description? It just doesn't feel like the sort of thing to which the relativity principle applies.
Because in some sense, you know, the reason the field is relativistic is because we have this. So, I mean, okay, it's better to do it in the Heisenberg picture, but I was translating into some kind of state picture. So essentially, the reason you can have a relativistic formulation is because if you boost your field, you know, there's unitary implementations of what it means to you know, you can implement that unitarily in your space. But if your notion of location is a superposition, it doesn't work anymore. So what I'm going to give is in order for that to be true, you need to be able to, technically, you need to be able to identify. So what you use is that you use two things. You use a property of the field, but you use also a property that in the Schrodinger base, it's kind of obvious that there's an operator that satisfies that. It's a technical point. So you need really these two elements. Okay, so you need to be able to represent boosts on your state, and you want the boost to be represented unitarily on superpositions of state, and then you can translate that into fields.
Okay, it's a different question. I wonder if Rob is done now, but if yes,
I mean, maybe I need to give a little bit more detail to, for it to be. But essentially, I want to, you know, change the notion of localization with respect to X, which is the Schrödinger localization, with respect to a modular localization. And this modular localization, the way we're going to see, is that in terms of state, it's really one is related to the other by superposition. But now if I have a superposition, it's absolutely not obvious that I can formulate the theory with the principle of relativity. And I'm saying I can. But maybe more questions are welcome. If that's, I agree that here, at this stage, you have to, I haven't given you the mathematical evidence. But does that, at least, does that make sense that, that, you know, having states that when I boost the argument somehow magically, this different state re-express itself as a unitary transform. You know, if you do at random this superposition, it's never going to be true. The fact that it's even possible is kind of a mathematical bizarrely, which is very powerful. And we...
Maybe if you could clarify exactly what sort of representation of the Lorentz group are you building here?
Like, yeah, yeah.
Because that's what I'm a big
Yeah. I need to give you more details. I agree. I haven't. I need to construct the modular. I mean, I have 10 minutes. But yeah, OK, maybe that's what I need to do. You have a, but I'd rather, OK.
Just very quick. The length scale that you have here, so if you don't take the quantum gravity motivation where the length scale is somehow fundamental, can you take relative locality also as a theory where it's somehow set operationally, where the length scale is coming from your devices or something like this, like in the double slit experiment?
I would like to take it to be not contextual in some sense. I mean, there is, yes. So I can, when I'm thinking of relative locality, I'm thinking there is a length scale, and it's not contextual, and it's the length scale that tells me how to superpose. And now the challenge, and that's my, the challenge is that I haven't shown you that that means necessarily quantum gravity as a force, okay? But yeah, that's the point of view I would take. Let's say, let's give up quantum gravity. I want to do that, but I want to have a non-contextual. I think if it's a contextual length scale, it's less powerful. But the idea that there may be a non-contextual length scale in the in physics, it's very powerful. I mean, if it's contextual, why would I care about Lorentz invariants? You know, my box is here, and then it's, you know, so therefore, you know. So let's say, even if it's contextual, I mean, Lorentz invariance is the key, or the ability to extend that. Okay, so what are the modular? Okay, so I haven't, it's lots of blah, 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 but okay. But I hope it was entertaining and inspiring. So I haven't tell you what is quantum space. Okay, so, okay, I need to give you a definition and work out. Okay. So, and I want to give a definition of space which is fundamentally quantum, so that I no longer have to fight to reconcile quantum and gravity. You see, the problem is, if you start with the notion of classical space and you build on fields on it and all sorts of excitations, at the end you have this humongous baggage on your space, and then you're trying to go back to that guy, which is everybody is sitting on it, and you're trying to move it, but it, you know, this huge pile and tons of objects on it, and it doesn't move, and it's impossible to make anything out of it. And that's the struggle. You know, you can witness quantum gravity papers as this humongous struggle. So a better point of view for me is first to have a definition of space which is organically quantum, and then, okay, try to put stuff on it, okay? Yes.
Back to my question. What?
I'm going to go. I, 2 minutes. I'm going to go back in your question. I know. Is that the same question or another?
Well, maybe if you start thinking about quantum space, you have to think about commutators.
Yeah, I'm going. Yeah, yes, yes. Yeah, we're going to. Okay. Let me. Give me 2 minutes. Sorry. It means, you know, I'm going too slow for you. Where is classical space entering? Classical space is entering I mean, classical space was put in quantum mechanics by Schrodinger, right? It's the argument of the wave function. This is where we locate things. So, and then this argument of the wave function, you know, being was promoted to something absolutely fundamental in relativistic quantum field theory, where we have the field, which cannot be defined if you don't specify for me a preconceived notion of space. And why it's so fundamental here, in some sense, the beauty is that non-relativistic quantum mechanics has more potential than relativistic quantum mechanics, because relativistic quantum mechanics cannot be defined without the notion of space, whereas non-relativistic quantum mechanics has other options, as was initially done by Heisenberg and Jordan, right? So in relativistic quantum mechanics, there's no other option because of microcausal locality, okay? In order to define quantum mechanics, you need to, one of the postulates, which is one of the most robust postulates ever, is the fact that if you give me 2 points in space, and they're space-like separated, you know, the commutator vanish. That's what space does for you. It allows you to define what it means for operator to be commuting with each other. Okay? So what is space here? What is this x? From the point of view of quantum mechanics, it's really the eigenfunction of the operator x. Okay? So what is the sets of, if I look at the algebra generated by all operators O of x hat, what happens is that this wave function diagonalizes these sets of operators, right? Any operator acts diagonally on the Schrodinger representation. So what is really space from the point of view of non-relativistic quantum mechanics? It is a choice of polarization. Okay, that's what space is.
When you say polarization, you mean a basis.
So it's a choice of basis. And more precisely, what I mean by a choice of polarization, it's really a choice of a commutative subalgebra. Okay, and let's call it star subalgebra. That is, it's commutative or subalgebra, which is closed under the star operation. Okay, it sounds very pedantic, right? I mean, you know, why we started from X and now we are talking about commutative star subalgebra. But I'm giving here the definition of polarization. Polarization could be defined as a choice of basis. I'm choosing the X basis or the P basis or the X plus P basis or the Z basis, okay? This is, of course, in quantum mechanics, and in fact, non-relativistic quantum mechanics really, you know, doesn't really care about and should not really care about what basis you do. So there's something very singular in the Schrodinger approach where suddenly, you know, a basis start to become almost physical, which seems almost to contradict the axioms of quantum mechanics and becomes even more radical when you go to field theory, because that basis is not only physical, it becomes essential to the definition. And it's even more radical in quantum gravity, because then in quantum gravity we say space is curved, but the conjugate variable cannot be curved. This is locality. Okay, so somehow this trick of Schrodinger, and you know, if you look at the history of the paper, what happens is that I think Heisenberg, Jordan, and Max Born, in fact, Max Born really wrote the first paper on quantum mechanics before Heisenberg. He discovered Cramer's formula. He discovered the quantization rule. He coined the term quantum mechanics. And he understood that motion, you know, has to be changed in terms of a collection of processes. But what these guys discovered was so weird at the time. It could not be processed. There was only like four or five guys, you know, Born, Heisenberg, Jordan, Pauli, and Dirac. And four of them were at the same city in Göttingen, so it was like this little club where they were all talking in terms of weird matrices and Q space and, you know. And then, of course, you know, Schrodinger came to save the world and somehow ease people and say, no, you don't have to question the notion of space to understand quantum mechanics. You can keep your notion of classical notion and everything is fine. And if it was only for Schrodinger, I think we could have survived it. But the next guy in town is the big guy in town. It's von Neumann, right? That came with this Stone von Neumann theorem saying, oh, there's only one polarization you can put on the Heisenberg algebra, or so it seems. And therefore, that's it. We never question back this choice of polarization, because von Neumann, and you don't argue with von Neumann. Minofoli is not around anymore, because I would be scared, right? I don't know if you ever read a paper von Neumann, but you cannot win an argument with von Neumann. So you know, this is a choice of polarization, and it comes from Schrödinger. So now, okay, lots of talk for, what I want to do is define quantum space by just reversing this argument. By definition, I'm going to take, what is space? By definition, space is the maximum amount of commuting operation I can do in my quantum system. Therefore, microcausal locality is just built into definition. No matter what space I have, it's always going to satisfy microcausal locality, because that's my definition of space. This is as simple as that. Okay, and then after that, it's only algebra. So quantum space. And mathematically, what is the set of maximum operation I can do quantum system? It's a commutative sparse subalgebra. Is the spectra of algebra. Okay? So this is my definition of quantum space, and you can think all you want. I don't think there is anything more that you can do. But you can challenge me on this one. This is my, you know. And this definition is fundamentally quantum. I cannot get that definition if I don't have a quantum system. OK?
Sorry, so when you say spectrum, you mean eigenvectors or eigenstates?
I mean the range,
sorry,
like the
eigenvectors or eigenvalues of that?
Eigenvalues.
OK. Because if you want to now think about the choice of basis, then obviously for a given set of eigenvalues, you can have very many bases that are all related just by similarity transformations of the original.
Yeah.
And so therefore, the locality, the notion of locality can change depending on your similarity transformation, even though the spectrum stays. So maybe
I'm going to have a commutative subalgebra, and then, you know, I'm going to have a specific set of generators, and then I don't think it's an issue. By spectra, I mean I'm trying to differentiate. In some sense, if X is commuting, I'm trying to say that what matters is not so much the. Thinking of X as an operator which is commuting with itself, or thinking about the spectra of X, I'm going to change that. So this is the question of. Here, you know, here it's a Q number, right? And here it's a usual number.
So what's the position of non-commutative?
Good. So what's new, okay? The first statement is that, okay, we're going to look at PQ equal IH bar, okay? And I want to do flat guys. So I'm going to put a linear structure here. I'm not going to turn on gravity. I could, but let's do simple. I'm going to look at the Weyl group. So for that, I need to assume that I have a fundamental length scale and a fundamental energy scale, okay, which are such that their product is h bar over 2 pi, let's say. So what can I do now is that I can define some variables which are p divided by epsilon, x tilde, which are momenta variable in some fundamental unit, and position variable in some fundamental unit. So that's my Heisenberg algebra. Now that I have a Heisenberg algebra, I can construct Weyl operators, which are operator of the form, exponential IP X. XT, things of that form. Okay, so let me go back to the modular paper before I do the mathematics and I state the result. What is new at the quantum? What's new at the quantum is that there are more commutative quantum algebra, then there are commutative classical algebra. Do people believe that? So I mean, by commutative is that if I'm in the classical realm, to define the dynamics, I have a structure which is the Poisson bracket, okay, which in general can be applied on any function phi of psi, okay, and it's a derivation on the two functions. Okay, so I can measure the notion of commutativity with respect to the Poisson commutative. Let's call it Poisson commutative. Okay, and it's one thing that you can prove, which is very easy, is that no matter, you know, there's no way in the classical realm, that is with a Poisson bracket, you can have a functions of Q never commute with the functions of P, unless this function is constant. Okay? So you cannot have a commutative. So in classical physics, the commutative subalgebra, commutative with respect to the Poisson bracket, are essentially polarizations in the usual sense. That is functions of P, or functions of Q, or functions of, you know, any other submanifold. Okay, so in classical physics, the only, if this is P and Q, the only polarization are real lines. Let's say I'm doing one-dimensional Heisenberg algebra, right? So the spectra of polarization in classical physics, it's R. And therefore, you know, we have the Schrodinger representation L2 of R, and if in dimension D, it's L2 of RD. And that's it. There's nothing else. Okay? Yes?
So I'm worried about the fact that the Poisson bracket might be ill-defined for the modular variables. I mean, if I think of modular position as a function, like imagine a classical modular variable, which is just a variable that takes its values in the range 0, 1, and it's, you know, take your usual position and just determine what the position is modulo L, okay?
Yeah.
In units of L. So that's a classical variable. And now if I think of it as a function of the regular position, it's discontinuous.
Yes, so how do I
evaluate the derivatives that
Very
good. Poisson brackets?
Very good, very good. So here, okay, you're totally correct. So let me be a bit more precise. If I think of the modular variable as, in fact, as this modulo, you're right, it kind of doesn't make sense. And in fact, this is the limitation of how it's developed in the Aronov book. You have to take, Aronov goes a certain way, but at some point his mathematics kind of gets in the way. And Toft, bizarrely, you know, when Toft has this picture where he wants the world to be a cogwheel, what he's doing is rediscovering modular variables. If you look at his paper, and he's technically proving theorem, but he's struggling with this discontinuity of the modulo variable.
Which paper?
He has a collection of papers. He came to give a talk here about the world is a cogwheel. Okay. And it sounds very, but it's very tough. It's like it sounds really weird, but you up on it, and there is, he has always an intuition about. So bizarrely tough, with his own reason that I cannot foresee how he got there, is trying to reformulate quantum mechanics in terms of modular variables. But let's try to understand the question. So in order to talk about modular variables, yes, I'm not going to talk about this P modulo Q, but I can look at functions which are periodic modulo something. Okay? So I can look at functions, let's call it U of P hat over L, and let's the conjugate function. So this is a function of P, okay? And this is a function, I can construct another function, V of Q, which is exponential I 2 pi q at over L. Okay? So this variable is periodic of period 2 pi, right? And V of q is periodic of periodic R. Okay, period R. So I can think of them as functions of the modular variable because they carry periodicity of the modular variable.
You okay. Mean L, not R, right?
Sorry, L. Yes. Okay. So now I can be more precise because I agree it was kind of ill-defined in terms So I can be more precise and state the same thing, is that that if I have a Poisson bracket and I compute U of P with V of Q, this will be different from zero, okay? No matter, and then any functions of P which is modular is kind of a linear combination of exponent of U, and any function of Q which is modular is a linear combination of powers of V, okay? So in some sense, you can then prove more precisely by Fourier expanding them that this will never happen, that you can never happen this commutation relation. Now, at least that sigma, let's say, these two guys. Now, the beauty is that at the quantum level, they do commute. So this is where you get a new opening, okay? The presence of Aaron-Boehm phases allow you to have, in fact, we can measure, but infinitely more commutative directions than when you don't. Okay, so somehow quantum mechanics opens up a wealth of classic. If I think of, let's say, this commutative subalgebra as kind of a mathematical definition of what you mean by classical reality, on which you're going to project your quantum reality, then what you're discovering is that quantum mechanics allow an infinite wealth of possible classical reality. And each one of these classical reality, and this would be maybe the purpose of another talk, because I have to stop. I can show you, as once you have the definition, I can construct these representations. And we can devise in what sense they're really classical reality and in what sense they have extra structures that makes it absolutely fascinating. So maybe I'm not doing to do, I think looking at the construction is interesting because there's a lot of subtlety in the details, but I don't think it's a good time to do it now. I've taken too much time. Maybe let me state the difference between, and essentially when you do that, you can show, suppose I'm looking at just the one-dimensional modular space, one-dimensional quantum space, okay? I'm saying that for one-dimensional quantum space, there's really two options, that's it. Not 4, not 25. There's only really two options. Either the space is classical, and if the space is classical, it has three properties. It's non-compact. It's, you know, R. It's simply connected. And I think there's a third, but I forgot. Okay. Now, let me just check. Sorry. It's non-compact. Oh, it's simply connected, and it's, let's say, it's of dimension one, okay? Obviously. Now, modular space, it's compact. It's non-simply connected. This is very important. It's because it's not simply connected that it can carry, even the pure notion of space can carry Aaron-Boehm phases. And therefore, I can make sense of superposition. Okay? And this is because of this support, that it can support Aaron-Boehm phases, that in some sense, it's not exactly, I give it a different name. It has intrinsically different properties than the classical space-time. And then its dimension is equal to 2. And in fact, if we look at it, it's equal to S1 times S1. Okay, so you're going to grant me that no matter what von Neumann says, this representation, even if it's unitarily, you know, he's a good mathematician, he's not proving wrong theorem, right? But you can grant me that spectrum R, spectrum S1 times S1 is absolutely not the same physics. Okay, so I think this is what's missed in the Stone von Neumann theorem, is that the spectra of your commutative algebra does matter. And in fact, what we can prove, and you know, if I give another talk, I can go to the detail, that if you pick at random a polarization of the Heisenberg algebra, it will always be modular. The only way to get a Schrodinger representation is to take a pick at random, a polarization, and then make the most singular transformation to it, squishing the size of the phase space set. And then I should. And I'm sorry, I haven't made it past the first section of the paper, but yes.
I'm going to ask just a dumb physicist question. What experiment could show us that we live in modular space and measure the value of the length scale?
What experiment? Well, the day I know that, I'm not going to say that publicly. I'm going to because that's going to be a big yes. That's the goal. The goal is that we're going to be devising a completely new type of experiment. Yeah, it's a completely new beginning. But I, you know, that's not the purpose of that talk. To answer that here, that's really the goal. The goal is that once you change the notion of space, there's a completely new window in terms of what type of observable you look at, what type of experiment, what type of interpretation. But I'm not claiming that I've demonstrated that to you. You have to be patient or be proactive. Yes?
How do you get the uncertainty principle?
Oh, yes, very good.
Not in modular space.
Very good, yes, yes. So. Yes, what happens with the uncertainty principle? It looks very bizarre. It means that you have a modular version of the uncertainty principle. Of course, everything becomes modular, you know, modular uncertainty principle, modular time, modular observables. But how do you do that? So even if I haven't described how you construct it, essentially what I'm saying is that the modular space, you can think of it as some kind of you can think of it as some kind of cell. Okay. You can think of it as some kind of cell in phase space, and the property of that cell is that the delta q, the area of that cell, is h bar. Okay, and of course the Schrödinger version is when you know, squish that cell to the momentum direction goes to zero, so you don't have any thickness in momentum space, and you recover absolute locality. That is the fact that physics, as we describe it in field theory, is independent on the energy scale you're probing it. Okay, but in a modular space, you would have a dependence on the energy at which you probe the energy scale. That would be maybe one type of observable. Maybe not. So now. What is the uncertainty principle? Is that I say you can locate yourself precisely in P and Q inside that cell, but the catch is that you don't know which cell you are in. Okay? That's the version of the uncertainty principle.
You trigger non-commutative.
No. No, that's the magic of these modular variables. I know, it sounds very... But so the uncertainty principle is that within that cell, it's like, think about a Brillouin zone. It's like, in fact, think about, it's exactly what happens in quantum crystals, where you have an electron, and the electron, when you try to localize, if you make an experiment on a quantum crystal and you try to say where the electron is, the only thing you can say is where the electron is in its Brillouin cell. But you cannot really tell which Brillouin cell in the lattice is in, and what you're probing with the observable is exactly that position in phase space inside the Brillouin cell, or same phenomena with the quantum Hall effect. So this is the version of the uncertainty principle. You know, I can prove it to you, but that's you can locate yourself precisely there. The reason I can locate myself precisely there because I showed that the value of these variables commute, so I can find states. This is the construction of the modular representation that I haven't done, which diagonalize both U and V. And therefore, I can have exact knowledge of where it is, modulo the periodicity, which means I don't exactly know which cell I am in.
We always have C numbers.
You always have?
C numbers.
Yes. I have both words. I have P and Q together, and they're both C numbers. Looks like a magic trick. But I know, but Aronoff is pretty, he's a tricky guy.
You're calling a rabbit out of a hat.
It's exactly what it is. But that's quantum mechanics, no, with the help of Aronoff.
No,
so I learned that, it's magic, I agree. But it's very simple, you grant me that. Yes.
So I think there's a part of the story missing here, or at least you haven't touched upon it, but it's relevant to this uncertainty principle. In classically, if I introduced a modular variable, then there's sort of another variable which, together with the modular variable, would give me back the original.
Yes.
And let me call that the discrete variable. So I have position, which can be broken up into the modular position and the discrete position. So the discrete position tells me which cell of width L I'm in, and the modular position tells me where I am within that cell. And it's the same with momentum. I can talk about the modular momentum and the discrete momentum. And so you've been focused on Poisson bracket relations and commutation relations among the modular position and the modular momentum variables. But my understanding is that the place where you're going to see conjugacy again and a failure of commutativity is between the modular position and the discrete momentum. Mm-hmm. So there's actually a more fine-grained uncertainty relation than the one you mentioned, which is that if you know the modular position, then you're uncertain about the discrete momentum.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes.
And if you know the modular momentum, then you're uncertain about the discrete position. So that's saying more than just you don't know which cell you're in. It's saying if you know, where you are within cells here, then you don't know which cell you're in and vice versa.
No, I agree. And I haven't told that story because that story becomes important with when you try to construct specific states. For instance, one thing I would like to say about this representation is not only that they exist and they are algebraic, but that they have a beautiful geometry in it. I want to talk about the geometry of this representation because, one of the goals is once I establish that quantum mechanics as a natural geometrical representation, which is related to understanding what happens to this localization, delocalization, I can look at quantum gravity in the other way around and think about gravitizing the quantum. And I could be more precise about what I mean. So I think once you get there and you understand that somehow the algebra, the representation carry a geometrical structure, it gives you a new perspective that maybe now I can play with the quantum itself. And maybe that's also what gravity is doing. But I'm not there yet. And I agree, I haven't. Okay, here, it's been very talkative. The paper is very mathematical, so I could give another talk which is more kind of, no talk and just pure math. Because now I've made my point, I hope, and then we can look at the details of and there's many things to explore, directions.
In terms of kind of things you can say non-mathematically, I guess the gloss that I would put on some of this that's maybe different from what you've put is
okay. Yeah, yeah.
It looks as if this is so different from the usual case because here you said, okay, modular position commutes with modular momentum. We're accustomed to thinking of these things as not commuting and there being an uncertainty principle, so this is really weird. But if you think in terms of discrete variables, you find that, okay, modular position does fail to commute with some aspect of momentum. It's just not the modular aspect of momentum that it fails to commute with. It fails to commute with the discrete momentum. So there's still a complementarity there between position and momentum. It's just not a complementarity between the two modular versions of those variables. It's a complementarity between the modular version of one and the discrete version of the other. And so it's really not such a big departure from the way we usually think about things when you phrase it in that language. And I suspect that there might be a better analogy between the classical Poisson brackets and the quantum commutators if you analyze it in that way, then what you've suggested here.
There is, yeah, I think there's a little bit more than that. The reason, okay, there's one technical reason is that when you try to construct these discrete momenta, you cannot. And I'll have to explain why. So some of the variable conjugated to that guy, and I know Aronoff used this notion of discrete variables as an operator, but it just doesn't exist. There's some version of it that exists, and the reason it doesn't exist is because there's one key difference, is the fact that now that my cell has some thickness in phase space, it carries units of Aronoff-Boone flux. Okay, so it means that I have a circulation there, which carries unit of Aralog-Bohm flux. What does that mean? It means that if I look at a wave function, so I can solve and look at these wave functions that are maybe, you know, function of x and x tilde, and I look at the circulation of the wave function around the boundary of my cell here. Okay, this object. So if I do that in a usual classical phase space, I can find that if I take any region bigger, you know, I can always find wave functions that do not vanish. This is absolutely impossible in the modular space. That is, there's always a point where the wave function vanishes because this circulation is equal to, you know, 2 pi I is equal to 1. Okay? So it means that somehow in a modular space, modular space is always equipped with some kind of quantum reference frame that you cannot completely get rid of. So in order to recover classical mechanics, you have to kind of, if you ignore that fact, then you're right. But that subtlety of the fact that there's always a point where the wave function vanishes, it's pinned. And this is the point where the Aralog-Bohm flux is supported, somehow tells you that the distinction between pure geometry and matter get blurred. There's an object in there, in any modular function, even completely pure, which carries the property of matter. It's kind of localized in your modular space. So that property, I think, is the fact that there exist always Aralog-Bohm phases and that the wave functions vanish on a point is very, for instance, the theory that claimed that you can take the log of the wave function and write it as a classical theory.
Bohmian mechanics?
Yeah, you cannot do that there. Because Bohmian mechanics assumes that the wave function doesn't vanish. Okay, and quantum mechanically, in a representation, this is not true. This is where the property of quantum mechanics appears. The fact that in a truly quantum mechanical representations, the wave function necessarily possesses zero, and this is the expressions of the uncertainty principle. So I could keep all the rest classical plus that. So maybe if you give me classical plus, points with phases, then I'm okay. But I would not. I think. This is a very important point. It sounds little, but this is the key difference. The rest, I agree, we could wash out. But that one, no. I think all the weird property of modular space hinges on that fact.
I have a question about the macro-locality.
Yes.
Field theory in classical space, you have this computation relation. Can you say anything correspondingly in the modular space?
Yes, but to do field theory, I would need to talk about modular time, which is not the, you know. I was saying space is by definition the place where things commute. I was using it, so microcausality is not a property I have to prove. It's built in. Okay. I'm taking something which is a big theorem of quantum field theory as just the definition of what space is. So microcausality, I think what you're asking is what is the modular quantum field theory based on that? And that would, you know, once I have it, I can answer Lee's questions. And that's the next step, of course. For that, though, I need to go back and understand what is modular time. Right? If you change the notion of space and you want to reconcile it with relativity, you have to change the notion of time. That's really, so far I was doing the easy thing with the magic of Aranov, right? The true crux is that we have quantum mechanics not only has to challenge your notion of space, but it has to challenge your notion of time. There's no other way around. Okay? And that's what everybody, even people in quantum gravity included, have never ever, you know, it's a big no-no. But once I have that, you have to go back again to any textbooks you know about quantum field theory and redo everything from scratch. Because it doesn't, you know, include the modular space in it.
How do you make space fully deterministic? Because everything commutes.
What do you mean? You mean, what is the time evolution I'm going to put?
Yeah, I mean, this is what Toft is trying to do.
Yeah, no, I'm not trying to do, sorry, I'm not trying to do what Toft is trying to do. But I have to acknowledge that Toft has this remarkable intuition. I'm not trying to say that it's fully deterministic. I'm trying to do that. All I've done today, think about it, I've just go back to Euclid and told Euclid, okay, quantum is fundamental. What is the quantum Euclidean space? And here it is. Okay, I mean, it's very, that's all I have done. Now you have we can talk about, I don't want to talk too much about, you know, to talk about determinism and causality. I have to talk about the dynamics in quantum modular space, which is another subject, which I'm, okay. I don't want to overclaim what I've done today. It's very, I've done something absolutely, I've done nothing, right? I don't know, or at least I'm 3,000 years ago plus one, right? It's just back there. It's just a long way to today, I agree, to, you know, you have to be patient. Yeah?
When you wrote down the commentators of P and Q, did they include, they didn't include time and energy?
No, I was talking about okay. A space, but we can talk, yeah. I mean, ultimately, I want to make that relativistic, introduce the constraints, and yeah, no, I haven't talked about that.
So earlier, when you wrote down some kind of a superposition of spatial,
it was space only.
And then there was another one which was line posted that actually just included rotations.
Exactly, rotations and evac translation. I haven't. Yeah, I mean, this is the math. It was when I say I can have the reconciliation of Lorentz invariants here, because I only have given you the definition of space. It means I can only mathematically reconcile translations and rotation with the discreteness, which is already not trivial. If you think about it. I claim that I have continuous space of translation even if my space is discrete, and I have continuous space of rotation even if my space is discrete, and this is the magic of superposition. But I haven't. Let's say time, I reserve for, I don't know, another, because time is special.
So do you think when, so now you have this modular space, and you have some kind of L, which is a spatial dimension, do you think when you add time also you can reconcile constant C with constant L?
Yeah, I have to. Yes, I have to. This is what the relativity tells me. I cannot, whatever I do on space, I have to do it on time. Yes. And this is really where it starts to be more interesting.
Okay, maybe we can end the seminar and we can continue discussing later. Let's thank the speaker.